close friend told her she always looked cross, she was surprised and a little thrilled that she could pull off such misdirection. In medical school, in full sari and now riding the bus, this quality grew stronger. Not crossness, but independence and misdirection. Some classmates considered her arrogant. She drew others to her like acolytes, only for them to discover she wasn't recruiting. The men needed pliancy in their women friends, and she couldn't bring herself to act coy or silly for their sakes. The couples who huddled in the library behind oversized anatomy atlases and whispered themselves into the notions of love amused her. I had no time for such silliness. But she did have time for trashy novels, set in castles and country houses with heroines named Bernadette. She fantasized about the dashing men of Chilling Forest and Locking Wood and Knotty Pine. That was her trouble then. She dreamed of a greater kind of love than the kind displayed in the library. But she was also filled with a nameless ambition that had nothing to do with love. What exactly did she want? It was an ambition that wouldn't let her compete for or seek the same things others sought. When, as a student at Madras Medical College, Hema had found herself admiring her professor of therapeutics, the lone Indian in a school where, even as independence approached, most of the full professors were British, when she found herself moved by his humanity, his mastery of his subject, face it, Hema, it was a crush. When she found herself wishing to be his understudy and found him encouraging, she deliberately chose another path. She was loath to give anyone that kind of power. She chose obstetrics and gynecology instead of his field, internal medicine. If the professor's field was limitless, requiring a breadth of knowledge that extended from heart failure to poliomyelitis and myriad conditions in between, she chose a field that had some boundaries and a mechanical component, operations. Of these were a limited repertoire, C-sections, hysterectomies, prolapse repair. She discovered in herself a talent for manipulative obstetrics, becoming expert at divining just how the baby was hung up in the pelvis. What other obstetricians perhaps dreaded, she relished. Blindfolded, she could distinguish the left from the right forceps and apply each in her sleep. She could see in her mind's eye the geometry of each patient's pelvic curve and match that to the curvature of the baby's skull as she slid the forceps in, articulating the two handles and confidently extracting the baby. She went overseas on a whim, but it broke her heart to leave Madras. She still cried some evenings, picturing her parents taking their chairs outdoors to wait for the sea breeze which, even on the hottest and stillest of days, blew in at dusk. She left because gynecology, at least in Madras, remained a man's domain, and, even on the eve of independence, a British domain, and she had no chance at all for a civil service appointment to the government teaching hospital. It was strange, and yet it pleased her to think that she, Ghosh, Stone, and Sister Mary Joseph Praise had all at one time or another trained or worked at the government general hospital in Madras. 1,500 beds and twice that number under the beds, between the beds. It was a city by itself. In it, Sister Mary Joseph Praise had been a budding novitiate and probationer. Perhaps they'd even walked past each other. And incredibly, Thomas Stone, too, had a brief tenure at Government General Hospital, though since the maternity section was quite separate, there'd been no reason for his path to cross with Hema's. She'd left behind Madras, left behind labels of caste, gone so far away that the word Brahmin meant nothing. Working in Ethiopia, she tried to make a visit home every third or fourth year. She was returning after her second such visit. Seated in the noisy airplane, she found herself rethinking her choices. In the last few years, she'd come close to defining the nameless ambition that had pushed her this far, to avoid the sheep life at all costs. Missing had felt familiar when she first arrived there, not unlike the Government General Hospital in India, but on a much smaller scale. People waiting in line, the families camping out under trees, waiting with the infinite patience of those who have little choice but to wait. She'd been kept busy from her first day. If the truth be known, she secretly relished the emergencies, the situations where her heart was in her mouth, where the seconds ticked off, where a mother's life hung in the balance, or a baby in the womb, deprived of oxygen, needed a heroic rescue. In those moments, she did not have existential doubts. Life became sharply focused, meaningful, just when she wasn't thinking of meaning. A mother, a wife, a daughter were suddenly none of these things, boiled down to a human being in great danger. Hema herself was reduced to the instrument required to treat them. But of late, she felt a huge remove between her practice in Africa and the frontiers of scientific medicine epitomized by England and America. C. Walton Lillehay in Minneapolis had just that year begun an era of heart surgery by finding a way to pump blood while the heart was stopped. A vaccine for polio had been developed, though it had yet to make its way to Africa. At Harvard in Massachusetts, a Dr. Joseph Murray had performed the first successful human kidney transplant from one sibling to another. The picture of him in Time showed an ordinary-looking chap, unpretentious. The portrait had surprised Hema, made her imagine that such discoveries were within every doctor's reach, within her reach. She'd always loved the story of Pasteur's discovery of microbes or Lister's experiments with antisepsis. Every Indian schoolchild dreamed of being like Sir C. V. Raman, whose simple experiments with light led to a Nobel Prize. But now she lived in a country that few people could find on the map.
"The Horn of Africa, on the upper half, on the eastern coast, the part that looks like a rhino's head and points at India," she'd explain.
And fewer still knew of Emperor Haile Selassie, or if they remembered him for being Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1935, they didn't remember the country whose cause he pleaded at the League of Nations. If asked, Hema would have said, "Yes, I'm doing what I intended to do. I'm satisfied." But what else could one say? When she read her Surgery, Gynecology and Obstetrics, each month's volume arriving by sea mail weeks after publication, bruised and stained in its brown wrapping, the innovations read like fiction. It was exciting, yet deflating, because it was already old news. She told herself that her work, her yeoman contribution in Africa, was somehow connected to the advances described in SG&O. But in her heart, she knew that it wasn't. A new sound registered. It was the scrape and rattle of wood on metal. The tail of the plane was packed with two giant wooden crates and stacks of smaller square tea chests, banded with tin strips stamped Longleat Estates, South India. Netting hooked to skeletal struts restrained the cargo from falling on the passengers, but not from sliding around. Her feet and those of her fellow passengers rested on bulging jute sacks. Fading military logos were stenciled on the floor and on the silver fuselage. American troops in North Africa once sat here and contemplated their fate. Patton himself perhaps sat on this plane. Or perhaps this was a relic from the French colonies in Somalia and Djibouti. The carrying of passengers felt like an afterthought for this new airline with its hand-me-down planes and ancient pilots. She could see the pilot arguing into the microphone, gesticulating, pausing to listen to the reply, then barking again. The passengers, who were close to the cockpit, frowned. Once again, Hema craned her neck to see if a crate with the Grundig was visible, but it wasn't. Every time she thought about her extravagant purchase, she felt a pang of guilt. But buying the Radio Coombe record player had made the night she spent in Aden almost tolerable. A city built on top of a dormant volcanic crater, hell on earth. That was Aden. But at least it was duty-free. Oh yes, and Rimbaud had once lived there, and never wrote another line of poetry. She'd picked out the spot for the Grundig in her living room. Most definitely it would have to be under the framed black-and-white print of Gandhi spinning cotton. She'd have to hunt for a quieter location for the Mahatma. She imagined Ghosh nursing his brandy, and Matron, Thomas Stone, and Sister Mary Joseph Braise drinking sherry or coffee. She pictured Ghosh leaping to his feet as the dazzling opening chords of Take the A-Train poured from the Grundig. Then came the cheeky melody, the last tune in the world that you'd have predicted to follow. Those opening chords, though, how they stayed with her. And how she resisted them. She resented the chauvinism of Indians who could only admire things foreign. And yet she heard those chords in her sleep, found herself humming them during her ablutions. She heard them now in the plane, strange dissonant notes thrown together, wanting resolution, and somehow they captured America and science and all that was bold and brash and daring and exciting about America, or at least the way she imagined America to be. Notes pouring out of the skull of a black man whose name was Billy Strayhorn. Strayhorn. Ghosh had introduced her to jazz and to Take the A-Train.
Wait! Watch! See? He said,
the first time she heard the melody after the chords.
You have to smile. You can't help it.
And he was right. The tune was so catchy and upbeat. How fortunate she was that her first introduction to serious Western music should be that tune. Still, she'd come to think of it as her song, her invention, and it annoyed her that he'd been the one to bring her to it. She laughed at the strangeness of liking Ghosh so much, when she wanted so much to dislike him. But just at the moment she was thinking these thoughts, anticipating her arrival in Addis Ababa, she found herself suddenly invoking Lord Shiva's name. The plane, the DC-3, the trustworthy camel of the frontier sky, was shuddering as if mortally wounded. She looked out. The propeller on her side fluttered to a stop, and a puff of smoke came out of the beefy engine cowling. The plane pitched to starboard, and she found herself plastered against the window. All around her, passengers screamed, and a thermos flask bounced on the cabin wall, spilling tea as it clattered away. She clutched around for a handhold, but then the plane righted itself and seemed to stop in midair before beginning a steep descent. No, not a descent. Her stomach corrected her. This was a fall. Gravity reached its tentacles out and grabbed the silver cylinder with its cantilevered wings. Gravity promised a water landing, or, since the plane had wheels, not floats, a water smashing. The pilot was shouting, not in panic, but in anger, and she had no time to think how strange this was. When, years later, she'd look back at this moment of change, look at it clinically.
Milk the history! Exactly when and exactly how did it start? Onset is everything! In the anamnesis is the diagnosis, as a professor would say.
She would see that a transformation actually took place over many months. However, it was only as she was falling out of the sky over the Bab al-Mandab that she understood that change had come. A little Indian boy fell on her bosom. He was the son of the only Malayali couple on board, teachers in Ethiopia, no doubt. She could tell that in a single glance. This knock-kneed fellow, 5, maybe 6 years old in oversized shorts, had clutched a wooden plane in his hand from the moment he came on board, protecting it as if it were made of gold. His foot had become wedged between 2 jute sacks, and when the plane righted itself, he fell onto Hema. She held him. His puzzled look collapsed into one of fear and pain. Hema spotted the curve in his shin, like bending a green stick, the bone too young to snap clean. She took all this in as her body registered that they were plunging, losing altitude. A young Armenian, bless his practicality, scrambled to free the leg. Incredibly, the Armenian was smiling. He tried to tell her something, a reassurance of sorts. She was shocked to see someone calmer than herself when all around the cries of passengers made the situation worse. She lifted the little boy to her lap. Her thoughts were both clear and disconnected. The leg is already straightening, but there is no doubt that it is fractured, and the plane is going down. She stopped his stunned parents with an outstretched palm and clamped a hand on the mouth of the wailing mother. She felt the familiar calmness of an emergency, but she understood the falseness of that feeling now that it was her life at stake.
"Let him be with me," she said,
removing her hand from the woman's face.
Trust me, I'm a doctor.
Yes, we know, the father said. They squeezed in next to her on the bench. The boy didn't cry, he only whimpered. His face was pale, he was in shock, and he clung to her, his cheek against her bosom. Trust me, I'm a doctor. She thought it ironic that these would be her last words. Through the porthole, Himalata saw the white crests getting closer, looking less and less like lace on a blue cloth. She had always assumed that she would have years to sort out the meaning of life. Now, it seemed she would only have a few seconds. And in that realization came her epiphany. As she bent over the child, she realized that the tragedy of death had to do entirely with what was left unfulfilled. She was ashamed that such a simple insight should have eluded her all these years. Make something beautiful of your life. Wasn't that the adage Sister Mary Joseph Praise lived by? Hema's second thought was that she, deliverer of countless babies, she who'd rejected the kind of marriage her parents wanted for her, she who felt there were too many children in the world and felt no pressure to add to that number, understood for the first time that having a child was about cheating death. Children were the foot wedged in the closing door, the glimmer of hope that in reincarnation there would be some house to go to, even if one came back as a dog or a mouse or a flea that lived on the bodies of men. If, as Matron and Sister Mary Joseph Praise believed, there was a raising of the dead, then a child would be sure to see that its parents were awakened. Provided, of course, the child didn't die with you in a plane crash. Make something beautiful of your life. This whimpering little fellow with his shiny eyes and long eyelashes, his oversized head and the puppy dog scent of his unruly hair, he was about the most beautiful thing one could make. Her fellow passengers looked as terrified as she felt. Only the Armenian shook his head at her and smiled as if to say, "This isn't what you think it is." What an idiot, Hema thought. An older Armenian, his father perhaps, was impassive, staring straight ahead. The older man had looked morose on boarding, and his mood now was no better and no worse. Hema found herself amazed that she should notice such trivial details at a time like this when, instead of deconstructing faces, she should be bracing for the moment of impact. As the sea rushed up to meet the plane, she thought of Kosh. She was shocked when a flood of tender feelings for him overcame her, as if he were about to die in a plane crash, as if his grand adventure in medicine and his carefree days were ending, and with it any chance of his achieving the thing he wanted most, to marry Hema. Chapter 4 The 5F Rule.
"Your patient, Dr. Stone,"
Matron said again, vacating the stool between Sister Mary Joseph Praise's legs. Seeing his face, she wondered if he was about to throw something. Thomas Stone was an occasional flinger of instruments, though never in front of Matron. It was rare that Sister Mary Joseph Praise ever handed him the wrong implement, but from time to time a hemostat failed to release with light counterpressure, or a Metzen bomb didn't cut at its tip. He had good aim. One spot on the wall of Operating Theatre 3, just above the light switch and perilously close to the glass instrument cabinet, was his usual target. No one but Sister Mary Joseph Praise took it personally. She would be crestfallen, even though she tested every instrument before she put it in the autoclave. Matron insisted the throwing was a good thing.
"Feed him a ratchetless hemostat from time to time,"
she said to Sister Mary Joseph Praise.
"Otherwise he'll keep it bottled up till it comes oozing out of his ears, and we'll have a right mess then."
The plaster above the light switch had stellate bits and scratches as if a firecracker had gone off there. The strike on the wall occurred after the word,
"Completely,"
and before the word,
"Useless,"
left his mouth. Once in a great while he exploded at Nurse Esqual, the anaesthetist, if the patient were too lightly under or had been given too little curare so that the belly muscles clamped down like a vice on his wrists as he fished inside the abdomen. More than one etherized patient had woken in holy terror, hearing Stone bellow, "I'll need a pickaxe if you can't give me more relaxation down here!" But at this moment, with Sister Mary Joseph Braze's lips ashen, her breathing shallow, her eyes seeing past him, her unrelenting bleeding, and then with Matron having passed the baton to him, Stone was speechless. He was experiencing the helplessness that patients' relatives must feel, and he didn't like it in the least bit. His lips trembled, and he felt shame at how his wet face displayed his emotions. But more than that, he felt fear, and an astonishing paralysis of thought which only shamed him further. When he finally spoke, it was to say in a quavering voice, "Where is Himalata? Why isn't she back? We need her," which was an act of uncharacteristic humility. He swiped at his eyes using the back of his forearm, a childlike gesture. Matron watched in disbelief. Instead of taking the stool she offered, he retreated. Stone walked to the wall that bore the marks of his anger. He struck his head on the plastered surface, a headbutt worthy of a mountain goat. His legs wobbled. He clung to the glass cabinet. Matron felt obliged to murmur, "Completely useless." On the off chance that if his violence had meaning, God forbid it should fail for lack of its accompanying mantra. True, Stone could have done a cesarean section, though, strangely, for a tropical surgeon, it was one of the few operations he hadn't done. "See one, do one, teach one," was a chapter heading in his textbook, The Expedient Operator, A Short Practice of Tropical Surgery. But what his readers didn't know, and what I learned only many years later, was that he had an aversion to anything gynecological, not to mention anything obstetrical. It stemmed from his final year of medical school, when he did what was unheard of. He bought his very own cadaver so that he could master the anatomy he had already learned so well on a shared cadaver in his first year of medical school. The male poorhouse specimen of his first year anatomy class had been ancient and shriveled with ghostly muscles and tendons, such being the common tender of Edinburgh anatomy theatres. He'd shared that body with 5 other students. But he lucked out with the cadaver he purchased in his final year, a well-fed, middle-aged female, a type he associated with the linoleum factories in Fife. Stone's dissection of the hand was so elegant, with just the tendon sheath exposed on the middle finger, while on the ring finger he carried it further to lay open the sheath and show the tendons of flexor sublimis like the wires of a suspension bridge, the profundus tendon coursing between them, that the anatomy professor preserved it to show the first-year students. For weeks, Thomas Stone toiled over his cadaver, spending more time with her than he had with any other female save his mother. He felt an ease with her, a fluency that came from intimate knowledge. On one side, he had filleted her cheek to the ear, tying the flap back with sutures to expose the parotid gland and the facial nerve passing through, its branches splayed out like a goose's foot, hence the name Pes Anserinus. On the other side of the face, he'd removed all subcutaneous tissue and fat to reveal the myriad muscles of expression whose concerted movements and life had conveyed her sorrow, joy, and every emotion in between. He didn't think of her as a person. She was simply knowledge, embodied, embalmed, and personified. Every evening, he folded back the muscles and then the skin flaps dangling on narrow hinges, and then he spread the formalin-soaked rags over her to ensheath her. Sometimes, when he fastened the rubber sheet around her and tucked the edges in, it reminded him of his mother's ritual of putting him to bed. Back in his room, his solitude and loneliness always felt more acute. On the day he removed the bowel to expose the aorta and kidneys, he saw her womb. It wasn't the shriveled purse he expected to find, sunk into the bowl of the pelvis. Instead, it peaked above the pelvic brim. A few days later, he turned to the pelvis, his his Cunningham's dissection manual open to the new section. He proceeded step by step, marveling at the book's genius as it unpeeled and unroofed and taut as it went. Cunningham's dictated a vertical slice through the front of the uterus, and then the operator was to gently pry the uterus open. He did, and out fell a fetus, its head a little bigger than a grape, eyes tightly shut, limbs folded in like an insect. It dangled on the umbilical cord like an obscene talisman on a headhunter's belt. He could see the mother's cervix destroyed and black from infection or gangrene. The catastrophe that befell this woman was memorialized in formalin. Stone barely made it to the sink before his dinner came up. He felt betrayed, as if someone had been spying on him. All this time, he'd imagined he and she were alone. He couldn't go on. He couldn't even look at her, or fold her back up to cover her. The next day, he asked the puzzled attendant to dispose of the cadaver, even though the dissection of the pelvis was incomplete and the lower limbs were untouched. But Thomas Stone was done. At Missing Hospital, because of Hema, Stone never had to venture into the territory of the female reproductive organs. That area he conceded, and it was atypical for him to concede anything, to her. He and Hemalatha were civil, collegial, and even friendly outside the operating theater. After all, Missing only had three physicians, Hema, Stone, and Ghosh, and it would have been awkward if they didn't get along. But in Operating Theater 3, Hema and Stone managed to provoke each other. Hema's style was precise and careful, a living example, Matron thought, of why more women should be surgeons. Matron sometimes believed she saw Hemalatha listening and then thinking when with a patient in the clinic, rather than trying to do both things at once. Hema was a surgeon who would throw four casts to her knots where others might be content with three. She never left the operating room until a patient awoke from anesthesia. Her surgical field was as neat and tidy as an anatomical demonstration, with vulnerable structures carefully identified and moved out of harm's way, and with bleeding meticulously controlled. To Matron, the field looked static, yet alive, like a painting by Titian or Da Vinci. "How can a surgeon know where she is," Hema was fond of saying, "unless she knows where she has been?" For Stone, minimal handling of tissue was what counted the most, and he had no time for the aesthetic of the surgical field. "Hema, if you want pretty, dissect cadavers," he once told her. "Stone, if you want bloody, become a meat cutter," she said. So vast was his experience and the practice that he put into his craft, that his nine fingers could find their way in a bloody field in which no landmarks were visible to others. His movements were economical and precise, and his results were excellent. On the rare occasions when a woman with the mud of the field still fresh on her feet was brought in with a bulgur wound that extended into the pelvis, or when a bargirl came with a knife or bullet wound near the uterus, Hemalatha and Stone would scrub together and enter the abdomen a deux, fussing at each other, bumping heads, and at times rapping each other's knuckles with the handle of the hemostat. Matron said she kept a register of which surgeon had stood on the right side at the last joint exploration, and she made sure they took turns. While Hemalatha meticulously resected uterus or repaired a bladder tear, Stone, who could not carry a tune, nevertheless whistled "God Save the Queen," which riled Hema. If Stone went first, Hemalatha would talk about the famous surgeons of years past, Cooper, Halstead, Cushing, and what a shame it was that tropical surgeons showed no sign of that great surgical legacy. Stone didn't believe in glorifying surgeons or operations. "Surgery is surgery is surgery," he liked to say, and on principle he would no more look up to a neurosurgeon than down on a podiatrist. "A good surgeon needs courage, for which a good pair of balls is a prerequisite," he had even written in the manuscript of his textbook, knowing fully well that his editor in England would take it out, but enjoying the experience of putting those words on paper. Stone had found a volubility, a combativeness and forcefulness in his writing that he didn't show in his speech. Courage? What's this you write about courage? Hema asked. Is it your life you are risking? A Caesarean section was technically not beyond Stone's abilities, but on that fateful day, the thought of taking scalpel to Sister Mary Joseph Praise, his surgical assistant, his closest confidant, his typist, his muse, and the woman he realized he loved, terrified him. She was already in appalling shape, pale and clammy, her pulse so thready that he believed anything he did would send her over the precipice. On a stranger, he might not have hesitated to try a Caesarean section. The doctor who treats himself as a fool for a patient was an adage he knew well. But what about a doctor who performed an unfamiliar operation on a loved one? Was there an adage for that? Increasingly, since the publication of his textbook, Stone had taken to quoting from it, as if his own written word had greater legitimacy than his unpublished and heretofore unspoken thoughts. He'd written, "The doctor who treats himself as a fool for a patient, but there are circumstances when he has no recourse." He had gone on to chronicle the tale of his own ray amputation, how he performed a nerve block on his right elbow, and then, with Sister Mary Joseph Praise helping, he had made the incision into his flesh, his left hand doing some of the work while Sister Mary Joseph Praise stood in for his right. He realized as he watched her make the bone cuts that she could do much more than assist if she chose to. It was the anecdote of the amputation, together with his picture in the frontispiece, his fingers, all nine of them, forming a steeple in front of his chin, which had made the book so successful. There were so many extant surgery texts that it was surprising how popular the expedient operator, or a short practice as it was known in some countries, had become. For a tropical surgery book, most of its sales took place in non-tropical countries. Perhaps it was its quirkiness, its biting tenor, and the often sharp and unintended humor. He drew only on his experience, or his careful interpretation of the experience of others. Readers pictured him as a revolutionary, but one who operated on the poor instead of preaching land reform. Students wrote him adoring letters, and when his dutiful responses, penned by Sister Mary Joseph Praise, didn't match the gushy confessional tone of their letters, they pouted. The illustrations in the textbook, all drawn and lettered by Sister Mary Joseph Praise, had a simple quality, as if done on a napkin. No attempt was made at getting proportion or perspective right, but they were models of clarity. The book was translated into Portuguese, Spanish, and French. "Daring operations performed in darkest Africa." That was how the publisher had described the book on the back cover. The reader, knowing nothing about the dark continent, filled in the blanks, pictured Stone in a tent, a kerosene lamp held up by a Hottentot providing the only light, elephants stampeding outside while the good doctor recited Cicero and excised a part of himself as blithely as if he were cutting for Stone on the body of another. What neither the reader nor Stone would accept was that his self-amputation was as much an act of conceit as it was an act of heroism.
"Your patient, Dr. Stone," Matron said for the third time. Stone took the spot between Sister Mary Joseph Praise's legs that Matron vacated, though, after all that, Matron seemed reluctant to let him by, as if she didn't want him to sit there any more than he wanted to sit. It wasn't a vantage point that he was accustomed to, at least not often with a woman. With men, he sat there to repair a watering can scrotum, and in both sexes he might be seated to drain rectal abscesses, or to ligate and excise hemorrhoids, or fistula in Arno. But otherwise, he was a surgeon who was rarely seated. When Stone clumsily parted the labia, blood poured out. He adjusted the gooseneck lamp and then his own neck to sight up the birth canal. He tried to remember the citrus rule from his student days. What was it? Lime, lemon, orange, and grapefruit corresponded to 4, 6, 8, and 10 centimeters of dilation of the cervix? Or was it 2, 4, 6, and 8? And was there a grape or plum involved? What he saw made him turn pale. The cervix was past grapefruit, on its way to melon, and there, as if at the bottom of a bloody well, was a baby's head, the tissues around it flattened. The fine, wet black hair on the skull reflected the theater lights. At that moment, it was as if someone who'd lain dormant within stone took over. If there was a connection between him and the poor infant within, it was something Stone didn't see. Instead, the sight of that skull agitated him. Fear was driven out by anger, and anger had its own perverted reasoning. What cheek this invader had to put Mary's life in jeopardy! It was as if he'd spotted the corpse of a burrowing mole that had attacked Mary's body, and the only way he could bring her relief was to extract it. The sight of that bright scalp wrought no tenderness from Thomas Stone, only revulsion. And it gave him an idea. "Find the enemy and win the firefight," was a saying of his. He had found the enemy. Flatus, fluid, feces, foreign body, and fetus feel better out than in, he said aloud, as if he'd just invented the phrase. In his book, he had called it the 5F rule. He drove himself to his terrible decision. Far better, he decided, to drill a hole in the skull of the mole, he'd already stopped thinking of it as a baby, than to experiment on Sister Mary Joseph Praise by doing a cesarean, an operation that was both unfamiliar and one that he feared would kill her in her fragile state. The enemy was more a foreign body, a cancer than it was a fetus. No doubt the creature was dead. Yes, he would tap that skull, empty its contents, crush it, just as if he were crushing a bladder stone, and then he'd pull out the deflated head, which was the part that was hung up in the pelvis. If need be, he'd use scissors on its collarbones, scalpel on ribs. He would grab, slash, slit, and smash whatever fetal part obstructed delivery, because only by getting it out could Mary be out of her misery and the bleeding cease. Yes. Yes. Better out than in. Within the boundaries of his irrational logic, this was a rational decision. Doing the wrong thing to do the right thing, as Sister Mary Joseph Praise might have said. To a shocked and horrified matron, the man who sat between Sister Mary Joseph Praise's legs didn't resemble their fierce, shy, and exceedingly competent Thomas Stone. This man had nothing in common with Thomas Stone, FRCS, author of The Expedient Operator. His place had been taken by this desperate, agitated fellow, who did not look like a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, but rather someone for whom the letters FRCS could mean, as Dr. Ghosh often claimed they did, farting round the countryside. Stone, animated now, consumed by a sense of mission, propped Monroe Kerr's operative obstetrics open, cookery book fashion, on the downslope of Sister Mary Joseph Praise's protuberant belly. "Damn it, Hemlata, you picked a hell of a time to be away," he said aloud, feeling his courage return. "Two blasphemies," Matron noted.
"Custody of the tongue," she murmured under her breath.
She took her own pulse, because despite her faith in the Lord, she was anxious about the heart flutter that had turned up in the last year like a surprise guest. Her heart was skipping beats now, and she felt faint. The strange instruments that Stone had requested and that Matron dug up from an old supply closet refused to be tamed by his hands. "Where the devil is Ghosh?" he shouted, because Ghosh often pitched in to help Hema with abortions and tubal ligations, and, as a jack of all trades, he had more experience with a woman's reproductive anatomy than Stone. Matron once again sent a runner over to Ghosh's bungalow, more to placate Stone than with any faith that Ghosh was back. Perhaps she would have done better to send the maid to inquire at the Blue Nile Bar or its vicinity for the Bunya doctor. But even an inebriated Ghosh could counsel Stone that what he was about to do was not the act of an expedient surgeon, but an idiotic one, and that his decision was wrong, his logic illogical. Matron felt this pregnancy, this birth, was somehow her fault. Some inattention on her part had resulted in this.
Still, she also assumed in the face of torrential bleeding that the child was long dead. Had she believed for a moment that the child was alive, she knew nothing about twins. She would have intervened. Stone cocked his head from side to side, trying to match Monroe Kerr's illustrations of instruments, smelly scissors, bronze cranioclast, Jardine's cephalotribe, with the objects he juggled in his hand. His tools were distant cousins of the ones depicted in the book, but clearly designed for the same sinister purpose. With two Jacob's clamps, he grabbed the oval of my brother's scalp. "I see you in the depths, burrowing creature. Damn you for torturing Mary," he muttered. Then, using scissors, he cut the skin between the two clamps and gave the intruder its first introduction to pain. His next move was to try to put the cephalotribe, the skull crusher, on the head. This awkward medieval instrument had three separate pieces. The middle was a spear meant to go deep into the brain, cutting a big opening in the skull as it did so. Flanking it were two forceps-like structures to clamp to the outside of the skull. Once all three pieces were in place, their stems interlocked to form a single handle with convenient finger indentations. Stone would be able to crush and grip the skull so it wouldn't slide away. Out would come the intruder. It was cool in the operating theater, but sweat from his brow trickled into his eyes and wet his mask. He tried to drive the spear in. The child, my brother, Shiva, sheltered for 8 months and already hurting from the cut of scissors on his scalp, cried out in the womb. I pulled him to safety as the spear slid over the skull. Stone decided it would be easier if he first applied the outer two blades of the cephalotribe, then dragged the head within reach, and then inserted the spear. His hands were clumsy in this awkward space. Matron shuddered at the damage he might be doing to Sister Mary Joseph Praise's tissues, and to the baby, as he jammed each piece past an ear until, finally, he had the skull in his grasp, or thought he did. Matron was close to dropping.
"It is the duty of the nurse to assist and anticipate the doctor's every need."
Wasn't this what she herself preached to her probationers? But it was all wrong, and she didn't know how to begin to turn it around. She was sorry she ever dug out the instruments. A humane obstetrician invented these instruments for mothers with the most desperate needs, not for desperate physicians. A fool with a tool is still a fool. In Stone's hands, the instruments had taken over, and they were doing the thinking for him. Matron knew that nothing good could ever come out of that. Chapter 5. Last Moments. At the very last moment, just as she braced for the plane to smash into the water, Dr. Himalata saw the ocean give way to dry scrubland. And before she could digest this, the plane flared to a touchdown over a shimmering asphalt, squealing its tires, wiggling its tail, and, when it bled off its speed, scampering down the runway like a dog unleashed. The passengers' relief turned to bewilderment and embarrassment, for the most godless among them had prayed for divine intervention. The plane stopped, but the pilot continued arguing with the tower while dragging on a cigarette, even though he had made a big point of turning on the no-smoking light after they landed. The little boy whimpered, and Hema rocked him with an adeptness she didn't know she possessed.
"I'm going to put a tiny, tiny bandage on your leg, okay? Then the hurt will all be gone."
The young Armenian somehow found a cane, and the two of them fashioned a splint. When the throb of the engine ceased, Hema felt the silence within the cabin press on her eardrums. The pilot looked around, a smirk on his face, as if he were curious to see how his passengers had held up. Almost as an afterthought, he said,
"We are stopping to pick up some baggage and some very important people. This is Djibouti."
He smiled and showed his bad teeth.
"They did not give me permission to land unless it is emergency, so I make an engine failure."
He shrugged as if modesty prevented him from accepting their accolades. Hemalatha was startled to hear her own voice shatter the silence.
Baggage? You bloody mercenary? What do you think we are, goats? You just shut down an engine and drop out of the sky like that and stop in Djibouti? No warning, nothing?
Perhaps she should have been grateful to him, happy to be alive, but in the hierarchy of her emotions, anger was always Trump's.
Bloody?
The pilot said, turning red.
Bloody?
He said, clambering out of the cockpit, white knees knocking under his safari shorts as he struggled free. He stood before her, huffing from the effort. He seemed to take far more exception to bloody than mercenary. His contempt for this Indian woman was greater than his anger, but he had raised his hand.
I will offload you here, insolent woman, if you don't like it.
Later, he would claim that he raised his hand merely as a gesture, with no intent to strike her. God forbid that he, a gentleman, a Frenchman, would strike a woman. But it was too late, because Hemalatha felt her limbs move as if by their own volition, fueled by anger and indignation. She felt as if she were observing the actions of a stranger, of a Hemalatha who had not previously existed. The new Hemalatha, whose license on life had just been renewed and its purpose defined, came to her feet. She was as tall as the pilot. She could see the tiny feeder vessel in the starburst on his left cheek. She pushed her glasses up on her forehead and met him eyeball to eyeball. The man squirmed. He saw she was beautiful. He fancied himself a ladies' man, and he wondered if he'd blown the opportunity to have drinks with her at the Guion Hotel that evening. Only now did he notice the people huddled over the whimpering boy. Only now did he notice the father's rage and the clenched fists of some of the other passengers who had lined up behind her. What a specimen, Hema thought as she studied him. Spider angiomas all over his exposed skin, eyes tinged with jaundice. No doubt his breasts are enlarged, his armpits hairless, and his testes shriveled to the size of walnuts, all because his liver no longer detoxifies the estrogen a male normally produces. And the stale juniper berry breath? Ah, yes, she thought, coming to a diagnosis beyond cirrhosis. A gin-soaked colonial resisting the reality of post-colonial Africa. If in India they still are cowed by all of you, it is from long habit. But there are no such rules on an Ethiopian plain. She felt her rage boil over, and it was directed not just at him, but at all men. Every man who in the Government General Hospital in India had pushed her around, taken her for granted, punished her for being a woman, played with her hours and her schedule, transferred her here and there without so much as a please or a bio leave. Her proximity to him, her encroachment of sacred Bhavana space, rattled him, distracted him. But his hand was still up there. And now, as if he just noticed it, he moved the hand, not to strike her, he would claim, but as if to determine whether it really was his hand and to see if it still answered to his commands. The upraised hand was insult enough, but when Hema saw it start to move, she reacted in a manner that made her blush when she recalled it later. Hemalatha's finger shot up the pilot's shorts and locked around his testicles, only his underwear intervening. There was an ease to her movements which surprised her, and an ease to the way the gap between her thumbs and index fingers allowed passage for the spermatic cords that connected balls to body. Years later, she would think that what she did was conditioned by her surroundings, by the propensity in East Africa for shifters and other criminals to lop off the victim's testicles. When in Rome, her eyes burned like a martyr's. Sweat changed the potu on her forehead from a dot to an exclamation mark. She had worn a cotton sari for the heat, and earlier, when she had been seated, she had hiked it to her knees, modesty be damned, and now that she was standing, it stayed that way, outlining her thighs. Sweat glistened on her upper lip as she squeezed to extract the same measure of distress and fear the Frenchman had caused her.
"Listen, sweetie," she said, deciding that there was indeed testicular atrophy and also trying to recall tunica albuginea and tunica something else and vas deferens, of course, and that craggy thing at the back, what's it called? Epididymis.
She saw his shoulder sag and the color drain out of his face as if she'd opened the spigot below. Dampness, quite different from sweat, appeared on his forehead.
At least your syphilis isn't far advanced because you can feel testicular pain, huh?
His upraised hand came floating down and then hesitantly, almost lovingly, rested on her forearm, pleading with her not to increase the pressure. A cathedral of silence descended on the plane.
Are you listening now?
She said, thinking that she didn't really want to know a man's anatomy this way.
Are we talking as equals? My life in your hands and now your family jewels in mine? You think you can terrify people like that? That little boy broke his leg because of your stunt.
She turned her head toward the other passengers, but, keeping her eye on Frenchie's face, said,
Anybody have a sharp knife? Or a Gillette?
The rustle she heard might just have been the cremaster muscles of all the males on board involuntarily reeling their dangling sperm factories back up to shelter.
We are unauthorized. I had to,
the pilot wheezed.
Take your wallet out right now and pay for this child,
Hema said, because she didn't believe in IOUs. When he fumbled with the notes, the young Armenian grabbed the wallet and handed it to the boy's father. One of the Yemenis, finding his voice, let out a stream of profanities, wagging his finger in the pilot's face. Hema said,
Now, you refund the plane tickets for the boy and his parents, and you get us back in the air very soon, otherwise you will not only be a eunuch, but I will personally petition the emperor to make sure that even a job as a camel driver, let alone flying cart, will be much too good for you.
They heard the cargo door open and sharp exclamations from the coolies milling around outside. The Frenchman, his eyeballs sinking in their sockets, nodded mutely. France had colonized Djibouti and parts of Somalia, and they had even jockeyed with the English in India before settling for a foothold in Pondicherry. But on this steamy afternoon, one brown soul who would never be the same again, and who had Malayalis, Armenians, Greeks, and Yemenis backing her, showed she was free.
Well, how can one be sane in hot weather?
Hemalatha said to no one in particular, letting go and making for the outside to wash her hands, stifling her laughter. Chapter 6 My Abyssinia. Hema fixed her eyes on the ground below, watching for the transition of brown scrub and desert into steep escarpment, announcing the lush, mountainous plateau of Ethiopia. Yes, she thought, this is my home now. My Abyssinia, which sounded to her so much more romantic than Ethiopia. The country was in essence a mountain massif that rose from the three deserts of Somaliland, Danakil, and Sudan. Even now, Hema felt a bit like a David Livingstone or an Evelyn Waugh exploring this ancient civilization, this stronghold of Christianity which, until Mussolini's invasion in 1935, was the only African nation never to be colonized. Waugh, in his dispatches to the London Times and in his book, referred to His Majesty Haile Selassie I as Haile Salacious, seeing cowardice in the emperors leaving the country in the face of Mussolini's advance. Hema's reading of Waugh was that he couldn't accept the notion of African royalty. He couldn't accept that the bloodlines of Emperor Haile Selassie, extending back as they did to the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon, made the Windsors or the Romanovs look like carpetbaggers. She didn't think much of Waugh or his book. The new passengers who climbed aboard at Djibouti were Somalis or Djiboutians, and really, she thought, what difference was there between the two, other than a line drawn on a map by some Western cartographer? They chewed cart and smoked 555s, and despite their doleful, muddy eyes, they were happy. Crammed into the plane, which by now was altogether too familiar to Hema, was cart, great bales of it being hauled back to Addis Ababa. It was all very strange, since cart usually travelled in the opposite direction, grown in Ethiopia, around Harar, and exported by rail to Djibouti and then by air to Aden. That lucrative cart trade route was responsible for the birth of Ethiopian Airlines. She overheard that some problem with the railway and road transport, as well as the urgent need for large quantities of cart for a wedding, prompted this reverse export and the unscheduled stop. Cart had to be chewed within a day or so of its harvest, or else it lost its potency. Hema pictured the Somali, Yemeni, and Sudanese merchants in the tiny souks that anchored every street and byway, and the owners of the bigger shops of the Makato and Addis Ababa eyeing their Tissot watches, snapping at their shopboys as they waited for this shipment. She pictured the wedding guests with mouths too parched to spit, but spitting and cursing all the same, telling one another that the bride was uglier than they remembered, and the big mole on her neck must mean she'd also inherited the miserliness of her father. Hema imagined telling her mother about the pilot business. It made Hema laugh, which made the Somali sitting opposite her, one of the newcomers, smile. Madras had been hot and humid for the 3 weeks that Hema was there, but it was heaven compared with Aden. Her parents' three-room house in the neighborhood of Mylapore, very near the temple, had seemed spacious to her as a girl, but on this visit it felt claustrophobic. Though she regularly sent her parents bank drafts, she'd been dismayed to find no improvements in the house since her last visit. The interior paint had peeled to form abstract patterns while the kitchen, blackened with smoke, resembled a dark room. The narrow street outside, which rarely saw a car, was now a noisy thoroughfare, and the compound wall showed no trace of whitewash, but instead was the color of the earth on which it stood. Only the garden had benefited from the passage of time, with the bougainvillea hiding the house from the street. The two mango trees had become huge and heavy with fruit. One was an Alfonso, and the other a hybrid with flesh that felt rubbery at first bite, but then melted in the mouth like ice cream. The sole decoration in the living room was, as it always had been, the Glaxo-powdered milk calendar hanging on a nail. The overfed, blue-eyed Caucasian baby had never grown up. The caption read, "Glaxo builds Bonnie babies." It was enough to make any breastfeeding mother feel guilty that she was starving her infant. As a child, Hema had barely registered the Glaxo baby. Now the calendar drew her eye and her ire. What an insidious presence that brat had been in her life. An interloper with a false message. Hema took down the calendar, but the pale rectangle on the wall called attention to itself in a way the baby never had. No doubt once Hema left, another Glaxo baby would find its way back there. During her brief vacation, Hema had the house painted and ceiling fans installed. Satyamurthy, the father of her old childhood nemesis Vilu, peered over the fence as workmen carried in a Western-style commode to be cemented over the footpads of the Indian toilet. He sniggered and shook his head.
"It's not for me, you old goot," Hema said in English. "My mother's hips are bad."
And Satyamurthy answered in the only English phrase he knew.
"Goddamn China! Kiss me, Eisenhower!"
He smiled and waved, and she waved back. The Somali across from her wore a shiny blue polyester shirt and a gold watch that swung on his thick wrist. His toes, protruding from sandals, glowed like polished ebony. He looked familiar to Hema. Now he bowed, grinned, and displayed his fingers as if bidding at an auction as he said,
"Three kids, two shots, one night."
She remembered. His name was Adid.
"I say, are you still doing double duty these days?"
His ivory teeth lit up the plane's dim interior. He said something to his friends. They smiled and nodded sagely. Such strong teeth they have, Himalata thought. She admired his blackness, a color so pure that there was a purple tinge to it. The headmistress at her school, Mrs. Hood, had been porcelain white, and the schoolgirls believed that if they touched her, their fingers would come away white. With Adid, she imagined they would come away black. Adid's regal manner, the slow play of expressions on his face, each thought matched by a lip-eyebrow combo, gave Hema the bizarre idea that she'd like to suck his index finger. She'd last seen Adid in a headdress and flowing robes in the casualty room at Missing,
unflappable, even though his pregnant wife was convulsing. When Hemulata unwrapped the shrouds of cotton, she found a young, pale, anemic girl. Her blood pressure was sky high. This was eclampsia. While Hemulata was in Theatre 3 delivering this wife of her firstborn by cesarean section, Adi